Do you want to know what it's like to hang out with MS-13 in El Salvador? How the Russian mafia fought battles all over Brooklyn in the 1990s.
Well, what about that time I got lost in the Burmese jungle hunting the world's biggest meth lab? Or why the Japanese Yakuza have all those crazy dragon tattoos? I'm Sean Williams.
And I'm Danny Gold. And we're the host of the Underworld Podcast. We're journalists that have traveled all over, reporting on dangerous people and places. And every week, we'll be bringing you a new story about organized crime from all over the world.
We know this stuff because we've been there. We've seen it. And we've got the near misses and embarrassing tales to go with it. We'll mix in reporting with our own experiences in the field, and we'll throw in some bad jokes while we're at it.
The Underworld Podcast explores the criminal underworlds that affect all of our lives, whether we know it or not. Available wherever you get your podcasts.
On February 9th of 2004, 21-year-old UMass student Maura Murray drove from her dorm in Amherst, Massachusetts to the White Mountains of New Hampshire.
At approximately 7:27 p.m., Maura spun out her 1996 Saturn on a hairpin turn on Route 112 in North Haverhill. There has never been a credible sighting of Maura since.
Maura is 5'7" tall. She weighs 120 pounds, and she has brown hair and hazel eyes.
If you have any information regarding Maura's disappearance, please submit it to us, the Murray family, through their Facebook page, or the New Hampshire State Police Cold Case Unit.
This is Missing Maura Murray. Welcome back to the Missing Maura Murray podcast. I am Tim, here today with Lance in the Crawl Space Studios in Wormtown. Lance, how are you today?
I'm doing pretty well. How are you today?
I'm doing all right. This episode airs a couple of days before the 15-year anniversary of the disappearance of Maura Murray, Lance.
Yes, it comes out on February 7th, so the anniversary is February 9th, and some people out there might be thinking, why aren't you guys up there in New Hampshire doing some sort of remembrance on your own? And we had talked about how the 15-year anniversary, and we even got an email from Julie and from Curtis saying that the 15-year anniversary was important for them. And frankly, we don't want to be that much of a distraction. And if the family wants to do their remembrance in their own way, I think it's for the best if we let the family do the family thing and just stay in the background. Now, that being said, go ahead and light a candle for Maura on February 9th. Tag us in all of the social media, and just keep her in her mind as you go about your day.
So take a picture of yourself with a candle on February 9th and post it to the Murray Family Facebook page at facebook.com/MauraMurrayMissing. We know they really enjoyed seeing all the support that the community gave last year, and they will definitely love to see it again this year. Speaking of last year, Lance, we're just going to throw it to a quick clip of me, you, Maggie Freeling, and Art Roderick talking with Julie Murray and Curtis Murray from last year's 14-year anniversary vigil, where they were telling stories about their sister, Maura.
I'm so glad we're going to cut to this and reminisce a little bit about last year, because that was a very special night for us. We were snowed in this little house, and we got to hear these personal stories from Maura's brother and from Maura's sister.
So I brought a lot of pictures that showed Maura with me, just because as the years have gone on, I've realized what a good big sister she was to me over the years. So like this here was her holding me when I came home from the hospital.
Oh, my gosh.
You know? And you can see here, she was so happy to be a big sister, and it showed throughout the years.
Because she took help from us.
Exactly. So you were all broken in. She got her turn. And then there you can tell we're related. You know? But that's one of the coolest things about Mara is I've thought about it over the years is, you know, growing up, I never had to pine for her attention or, you know, seek her out. She would always come find me. You know, no matter what she was doing, like we used to do grocery shopping together all the time. And that was a big event. And she'd always make it fun for me because we'd have, you know, we'd usually go late at night and we'd stage like little races throughout the store or, you know, see who could get all the items on the list fastest. Or she'd put something at the end of an aisle and we'd go like go to the opposite ends and race from one end of the store to the other to see who could get there first. And that was really cool, you know. And she was always so present and made it such a point to be present in my life. And that was really special. And I've realized that as years have gone on, as I've reflected on it more.
Mara would always write cards. She never missed a birthday. This is a card she wrote to my mom. She says, "Hi, Mom. Hope this reaches you in time. Thanks for everything over the years. I feel bad about not calling, but I never get in until late. I need a cell phone. Finals end the 21st, and Bill's coming to New York for Memorial Weekend. I'm not sure if I'll be home in between, but with all you've dealt with from us kids, you deserve an extra special Mother's Day. Love, Mara." So, again, it just, that's who she was. You'll see that trend in everything that she ever wrote.
All right, so I have this one. This is actually a picture of the first mountain I ever climbed with Mara. I don't know what the hell I was wearing, but that was the first mountain I'd ever climbed. It was Mount Shakur, not far from where we are now. And, you know, like everything else, she made that fun. Instead of torturing me and making me keep up a pace, she took breaks. You know, appreciated the scenery and stuff. Mm-hmm. It was a really good experience. And most of the hiking I did up here, I did with Mara from a very young age. Here's a picture of the whole family. And Mara, as usual, you know, holding me or something, you know. She was always either torturing me, you know, around me, whatever.
When was this?
That was, I was probably like three or four years old at that point. I don't know exactly when it was, but... Here's another one. Mara getting ready for prom, me ready for baseball. She using me as an armrest. That was typical. You know, she was always good. I mean, we always did like batting practice and baseball practice and stuff out in the cul-de-sacs. And, you know, that was a big thing for us. She used to, because she knew how much I love baseball. You too. And we always practiced all the time. It was awesome.
What other sports besides track was Mara, did she excel at?
Anything she
all
tried.
All sports.
Anything she tried. She was unbelievable that way. Didn't matter what it was, she'd pick it up. Even golf, we used to go to the driving range all the time. Mm-hmm. She was big into that.
Wow.
Yeah.
She just loved competing or just was so naturally athletic or both?
A little bit of both, I think.
Yeah, Mara and I were really competitive. Yeah. You remember that.
Oh, yeah.
Like, things got heated, like...
Competitive with each other?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Especially when she got to West Point, or...?
No, like...
Leading up to that.
Dumb, like, foul shooting contest.
okay.
But she always beat me, so... Yeah, off the porch, like, crazy stuff. When she was a freshman in high school, she... entered the state free throw competition.
Oh, geez.
Do you remember this?
Yep.
Yeah, and she beat everyone, and she went on to the quarterfinals, yep. And you kind of do... I don't know if it was like 10 and who gets the best. It was probably right. More than that. But anyway, she made it all the way to the Boston Garden.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
So I remember I was essentially her rebounder or ball girl or
right.
Something. But I wasn't allowed on the court.
I remember those contests.
Yeah. It was a huge deal. Yeah. And so she was star runner, but also in the garden shooting free throws for the state championship as a freshman.
Wow.
So...
And didn't she get banned from pitching in softball because she was too good or pitched too fast?
She was too fast.
She pitched too fast for everybody.
Or something.
And they wouldn't let her pitch. Isn't that why she stopped playing?
I think so. I don't know.
That's crazy. Yeah. Wow. So she was just that good at most everything.
How old was she when she was too fast of a pitcher in softball?
I think it must have been middle school.
Yeah. It was unreal.
Was she pitching like 70?
She was pitching fast.
Really fast. Wow, vicious good. Windmill. It was great. Vicious windmill. Yeah. Yeah, it was good. And you know what was cool about her is that no matter how good she was at something, she was always so humble and couldn't take a compliment to save her life. Really? Anyone complimented her, she'd clam up and turn red, didn't know how to take it. Yeah.
All right, Lance, and in just a little bit, we're going to take a look at Billy Jensen's old article, Will the Internet Help Find Missing UMass Student Maura Murray?
And we realized going over this article would be a good idea when you and I were doing our creator commentary of the early episodes.
You mentioned the creator commentaries, Lance, and we've been getting some emails about where are the first 10 episodes of Missing Maura Murray and why are they not on the feed. Here's one from Janelle asking that same thing. Just so you know, we are getting the emails about it, but the first actually 20 episodes are now off the public feed and are on Stitcher Premium. So you got to go to stitcherpremium.com, use promo code MMM, and you'll get a free month. And after that, it is $4.99. But what you'll get is all of the original episodes ad-free of Missing Maura Murray. You'll get our creator's commentary, which is us today, Lance, in the end of 2018 and 2019, talking over these episodes that we recorded 3 years ago.
Right. It's really informative because it's present-day us going back to the 3 years previous us and also the information we had at hand at the time. So you get a fresh look at everything, and you get to hear us giving ourselves a fair amount of grief at the same time, which is therapeutic for us as well.
In addition to that, Lance, you're going to get every archived episode of Crawl Space on Stitcher Premium. Also, our art crime show called Empty Frames.
Empty Frames is a great show.
Got to check that one out.
Fun show.
True Crime Garage does a show on Stitcher Premium as well, so I think it's definitely worth it. Check it out.
Yeah, there are dozens of shows, comedies, true crime, any genre you want.
Also, we want to mention that we appeared on the show Criminology just recently, and that's our good buddy Mike Morford's podcast and Mike Ferguson as well. They do a great podcast called Criminology, and they did two episodes on Maura Murray, and we joined them in the second one, and that should be up in a couple days.
It was a real pleasure to talk to those guys. They're truly professionals. The coverage that they did for Maura was really good introduction, and I really am humbled that they reached out to us to give a more detailed, deeper dive into it for an episode. So listen to everything that Criminology does.
Also, Lance, the American Investigative Society of Cold Cases is having a conference in Albany April 15th and 16th, 2019, at the College of St. Rose.
And we will be there with our buddies from Criminology and our new buddy, Kenneth Maines.
Yeah, yeah, we're doing a panel with Mike Morford and with John Lorden of Brain Scratch.
How could I forget to mention John Lorden with his snappy duds?
And we're going to be talking about what it's like to podcast in this true crime media day.
Working with law enforcement, trying to figure out how to responsibly disseminate information and who to disseminate it to when you get it because you're talking about cold cases.
It's going to be a great conference. Here's a clip from our upcoming episode of Crawl Space with Kenneth Maines. So check it out. Subscribe over there at Crawl Space. And here is the clip. Tell us about the American Investigative Society of Cold Cases. This is a conference happening in April.
Yeah, the American Investigative Society of Cold Cases got started when I got stuck on that Gail Matthews case. As I said, you know, 6 months, I thought I would have it cracked. Well, I got stuck. And I'm like, what do I do? What do detectives do when they get stuck on a case? One thing I knew was not going to happen was I was not going to put that case back in the drawer because that's how it got cold to begin with. So what do we do? And I said, you know what? I'm going to start an organization with various disciplines, which is very important to me, that the case is looked at not just through a homicide detective's eyes. I wanted it looked at through academia, behavioral science, forensic science, pathology, all of that. So because everybody sees things differently. So that was very important to me. And out of that, I created. I started, you know, being a fan of true crime or mysteries. I knew who the best were. You know, I didn't have to research it. I knew Henry Lee. I knew Cyril Weck, Warner Spitz, Mark Saffery, Joe Kenda, all those people, and Mary Ellen O'Toole, Bob Keppel. I knew those names. So I just started reaching out to them. I sent them, you know, a heartfelt letter saying, hey, this is why I'm creating this. I know there's the VDOC Society, and I love them. Richard Walter, who was a co-founder of them, I went to his house, spoke cases with him. But I think there needs to be more, you know, and that started the American Investigative Society of Cold Cases. I started getting responses back from Henry Lee, Cyril Weck, and they all believed in my vision. And that started it, and it's grown. Now we're in our sixth year, and we keep growing and we keep looking at cases. And I think of it as a very great organization that keeps the spotlight on some of these cases.
So this is April 15th and 16th of this year. It's at the College of St. Rose in Albany, New York. And what can people expect when they go?
Well, at our conferences, what they can expect is to learn something about cold cases. That's the most important thing. But it's also a great opportunity to not only meet some of these people that you have just heard about or seen on TV, you can talk cases with them and really just network. And if you're there and you talk about a certain case with somebody, maybe they can see something that will help you. So it's open to the general public. Anybody can come, you know, and that's very important to me as well. Is before there was some pushback that we should just limit it to law enforcement. And that's when I was in law enforcement. I just retired in March. So, you know, in the past it was, well, let's just limit it. I don't believe in that because, like I said before, I think amateurs who just are not cops can see and know just as much as cops can. So I certainly try to steer away from it just being law enforcement. Anybody can come, they can learn, and they can have a great time.
Well, that's great. Yeah, I think this is an awesome conference, and we are thrilled to be a part of it. And we're going to do a speaking panel with Mike Morfort and John Lorden about how true crime podcasters and true crime YouTubers, specifically like John Lorden, can kind of interact with families of missing people or murder victims and also law enforcement in bringing light to these cold cases.
And I think that is extremely important. And I'm so glad that you guys are going to be there and doing that.
Now, this the AISOCC has partnered with Sorensen Forensics.
Correct.
Yeah, that's really cool. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, ASOC, we have our own lab, which is run by our DNA expert, Susanna Ryan. And we strictly use the MVAC system. And with Jared Bradley kindly donating a system to us to use. And if law enforcement has evidence that they need tested, we'll do it pro bono, and Susanna will collect that DNA through the MVAC. We partner with Sorensen Labs so they can extract DNA, and it's all done pro bono. And I think more law enforcement need to take advantage of that.
All right, so we just wanted to read a few emails before we get into this retrospective part, Lance. And one thing I wanted to address real quick from an older episode, from episode 84, called Mora's Supervisor. Andreas says, this is weird. I'm sure Karen is completely innocent in all of this, but she's ticking a lot of the boxes that someone would who is hiding something or lying. Like using 100 words where only one would do, talking very quickly, giving far more information than is needed, sounding nervous, that sort of thing. And he goes on, again, I'm 100% sure she's innocent, but maybe she drank too many espressos that morning.
I can attest to her not drinking espressos that morning. I think she's more of a Dunkin' Donuts gal. She was drinking Poland Springs sparkling water while she was here, so there was no caffeine going into her. I think that's just the way she talks. And to be perfectly honest, I make fun of myself all the time for using too many words when I could have just used one or two to quickly synopsize or summarize something. See, I just did it there. Does that mean I'm guilty of something?
No, no, it doesn't. And Karen Mayotte is not guilty of anything as well, Lance. And, you know, we heard the way she spoke in the editing, and we were like, well, we could kind of trim some of these ums and ahs a little bit, but it just she does talk so fast that it was really tough to even do that with it still sounding natural.
I think it's a character trait, the clipped way she spoke with a lot of those quick ums. I think it's just a character trait, but I will say, I love getting comments like this, that people pay this much attention. So,
and it's not the only one we got on that that episode. Yeah. We got several from people who said something very similar about Karen and her speech patterns.
So bring these things to our attention. As long as you're respectful like that, I think it's all good.
And we saw a pretty strong reaction from the last episode, Lance, and I think there was 60 comments on our YouTube video with for episode 94, new lead update and more. So let's read some of these. Moondust 99 says, great episode. Thanks for addressing the new info. I am shocked by all the John hate, though. If he hadn't posted, you wouldn't be talking about it, and maybe the police would have gotten away with ignoring the lead. If she is there, we obviously would have John to thank. Since the early podcasts, John has said a lot of BS, but the A-frame, blood, witness A, and the whole she didn't hit a tree all came from him. Your comment about him putting forward false info is very pathetic, considering all of those revelations came from him and were good enough for you to air.
One of a couple of things that she says in this comment is what if John didn't put out the lead, then the police would get away with ignoring it. So she's acknowledging that a lead would exist, and if John didn't say this publicly, then they would get away with ignoring it, assuming that they're ignoring it. Well, we do know that they have been to the location upwards of 3 times, and they have searched with their own dogs, and they've concluded that there's nothing of value there, evidentiary value. So what we can sort of draw our own conclusions around is that there might be something there, but it probably has nothing to do with Maura, and it might not even have anything to do with a crime.
And let it be known that, just to reiterate what Maggie said in the last episode, we would love for the police to search this again. This does seem like one of the more optimistic leads in the past several years. But I think going back to the point of the conversation in episode 94 was this information should not have been put out there in the first place, as evidenced by the very guy taking it down right afterwards.
Regardless of what was looked at before or your feelings on whether the police are ignoring it or covering it up, this could be something. It could have been something.
No, it still could be. And yeah, let it be known, this is not an attack on John Smith. This was not meant to attack him personally in any way whatsoever. John would give anything to help this case. He helped us during the run of this podcast, and we saw firsthand what good he has done and can do in this case. We respect John and his advocacy and appreciate when he uses his influence to help the case. But we get annoyed at him when he uses it for name-calling or for selfish reasons. And we're guilty of putting things out there at times that maybe shouldn't have been out there, but I would like to think that we can learn from our mistakes.
I think when you're operating in this medium with the rapidness that information can come at you, and especially when you're green to the whole thing, like you start your podcast or you start your blog and you're getting information, you think everything instantly is the thing to put out there. So it does take some time to take a step back and consider all of the information and what should be put out there and what should be kept to yourself until the right time comes.
We talked about the lead being put out there. The truth is the police had been to the location before, and hopefully they go again. They were going to go again, I would say, with or without John posting about this on Reddit. What this does that is not great, and hopefully people can see, is that it makes some of the locals not trust their law enforcement. And I know a lot of you are shaking your head or you're saying, of course we don't trust law enforcement. Well, you know what? There are a lot of good guys in law enforcement. Let's be honest, not every police officer in the country or in the state of New Hampshire has nefarious things on their mind. In fact, most of them are just trying to do their job well.
Especially on a police force of four that cover a lot of ground. There's a lot of area for those police officers to cover, and they deal with a ton of knuckleheads on a daily basis. So this is not something that they're actively looking to do. Maybe I'm being super naive, but I don't think that they're actively looking to or contributing to some cover-up involving missing people in that area.
I don't think so. It does seem like they will go to this location and check it out again. Apparently they had previously, but it does sound like they will perhaps in the spring. So we hope they do.
Same episode, Scott Stapp commented on the video.
Oh, I saw that.
Doesn't really matter what Scott Stapp says, but he commented on it. That's it. I can't really make out what he was getting at, so I didn't want to read it.
He said Maggie's vocal fry makes him
sending him into a rage.
Yeah, sounds like he's violently angry about it.
What's a vocal fry?
I think it's when you got a dog like
this
a little bit. Yeah.
Oh, but, no way. Okay.
Yeah. Well, if that's sending you into a rage, I would say seek anger management help.
I think it's ironic that Scott Stapp is commenting on someone's vocal abilities.
Here's one from 350 Mac. Stop the JS bashing, and Maggie said she didn't reach out to Bill R. That's a lie. Go to the Oxygen show and rewatch it. And actually, what happened in the Oxygen show does show Maggie placing the call to Bill Rausch, but that's just the magic of filmmaking, people. Actually, the producers, like Maggie said in the last episode, the producers placed the call to Bill Rausch and sounded like one of them spoke to him, and I'm not sure of that. That's just based on what Maggie said.
But let's not take this as the TV show or Maggie putting together some narrative that doesn't exist to cover something up. It's just basic production work.
You know, it would be a lot weirder if they showed Eric or Robbie, one of the producers, calling Bill Rausch, and then the audience would be like, who the F is this guy?
Where did he come from?
Why didn't Maggie make that call?
Why am I not looking at the attractive young woman with the tattoos that I've been following the entire time?
Right. So Maggie made the call in the TV show, but what actually happened was that one of the producers made the call to Bill, and they filmed Maggie doing a voiceover saying we called Bill. It was just a shot of her on the phone. Speaking of those tattoos, Lance, a lot of people kind of came at us and said we were taking personal shots at John. I want to almost save this to the end of the show, but this isn't a petty thing, a tit-for-tat thing. We have kept very quiet about the criticism that John Smith has given to us and to Maggie over the past year plus, calling us names, putting our addresses out there on Twitter and YouTube. He wrote a tweet about Maggie calling her a stupid tattooed bitch. So if you think we're immature about this, you have to check yourself.
Yeah, just go through his threads, his timelines. It's really not even about the criticism or the names. Like, we can take that. We got thick skins for that. It's about the putting the addresses out there and accusing us of being part of some conspiracy or accusing us of making a ton of money and profiting off of all of this. I don't regret calling him out on putting out information that shouldn't be put out there when it's a lead and you're only doing it for your egotistical purposes. I just want to read the first line of this one from YouTube, from New England's Insomniac Theater, which is a great name. It says, finding a new lead in this case is like looking for a drop of water in the desert. You should take whatever you can get. And I get it. And I love that. And we will take whatever we can get. We should take whatever we get as public figures and citizens. But we should understand that the police can do whatever they want to do or feel that is the best thing to do when they get a lead. And we should not question that without some sort of solid proof that there is something sinister going on in the background.
Here's an email that we got last Thursday from Ashley Clark. You literally only read the emails that make yourself look better, or an excuse/liberal softball question, so that you can defend yourselves and pass slander that you have spread regarding the Murray case and those dragged in by just living here. Do you ever admit that you have done something reckless? Nope. No balls. You constantly talk shit about people in our town and never apologize. You are a FAG. Stay out, Flatlanders. We don't want you help or want you here. I am a native, and we are sick of you walking on our lawns and spreading lies. You both are total pussies, and I think you two both are gay as hell together. Get over yourself or go back to your mom's basement. Guarantee you won't read this full email on the air because, like my subject reads, you are so egotistical. Also, you are both high-pitched voiced males who have no balls. This isn't a threat because I wouldn't waste my time on losers like you. Also, every cop thinks you are both major pains in the ass creating more work on a chick who probably just ran away to Canada. All you want is your stupid hair color and bra money, which you probably wear, to be in the spotlight. When your balls drop, maybe you can make a new podcast. Until then, stay off our land and get the hell out of our state, Flatlanders. X, Ashley Clark.
All right. Thanks for listening, Ashley.
A couple of things here. Very incorrect about a lot of these things. First of all, calling us gay, that's not that there's anything wrong with that, but that is completely incorrect. We both live with our girlfriends. Living in our mom's basements, not accurate.
Never lived in my mom's basement.
Me neither. We don't have high-pitched voices. That's very inaccurate.
I don't have as much bass resonance as I'd like to, but can't help the way I was born.
All we want is our stupid hair color and bra money, which we probably wear. That is incorrect, and that is not all that we want.
It's not all we want, but we do appreciate Madison Reed and Third Love.
The sponsors do allow us to continue to do the show, so we do really appreciate the hair color and bra support we get from Madison Reed and Third Love, just to mention a few.
Does it really come down to that, though? Like, you guys are in it for the money, for your take your bra and hair color money.
I'll tell you what, I'm so sick of that argument.
Anybody wants to see my bank account, have at it. Email me and I will give you my balance, my daily balance, and I'll be honest about it. What a short-sighted fool. Honestly, the reason why we try not to read a lot of the negative feedback that we get is because it's toxic and it pollutes the community. And once we start reading that, we'll get more of it, and then we'll get bogged down by it. And personally, I think that we do a pretty good job disseminating information the best way that we can in order to keep the conversation about Mora and other missing women, men, children, keep that conversation going and keep the people talking about it. The exposure is necessary. Anytime we go to Crime Con, you see just the amount of people that are compassionate humans that want to help and just make things better. And we have Ashley here, who would rather call somebody a fag as a derogatory term because he lives there and you better stay off their lawns. They're sick of you. We have that. Yeah, we don't want to read that. We don't want to put out there that the people up there in New Hampshire are actually like that.
Yeah, some of them, apparently.
Some of them.
Not all of them.
Not all of them are like that. We've experienced the ones we say all the time. Respect the people's privacy up there. The people live there for the reason that they don't want to be around a big city. They want people around them that they care about. There are very, very good people up there who have invited us in their homes, and we've accepted, and we're friends with them. And then there are people who would prefer to not interact with us, and that's fine. We've respected their privacy. We haven't trounced around lawns. We don't spread lies.
I don't think we've ever told a lie on the show.
Spread lies. We
never.
We walk around backyards and just yell out lies just to the air.
As they say in the South, Ashley, bless your heart. Here's a good email from Katie. Tim and Lance, I've been listening to you both for well over a year now and always look forward to your podcast. The recent episode severely upset me. From everything I've read, this new lead and information seems very credible. For Maggie and the police to dismiss it like it is nothing is very disheartening for everyone that has been following the case. Let me stop you there. I don't think Maggie or the police have dismissed this at all. Maggie said she hopes the police search it in the spring, and we heard that the police might be going there in the spring. So let's move on. The constant jabs that were taken at John Smith were unnecessary. This is a man who helped Fred and the family immensely from the beginning. It made me and many others, as seen in the comments from Facebook group, very appalled. It was hard to listen to, and she includes some screenshots from those Facebook groups. She says, we appreciate everything you guys do, but this episode was very hard to get through. Let me add that probably because of the ground is why the law enforcement wouldn't be there until the spring.
That is probably a really good estimation as to why they're waiting a certain period of time. But it sort of is not a contradiction that they take it seriously, but they're not going to do anything until the spring, regardless of why they're waiting to the spring. They have been there before. They might already know what the situation is, which they take seriously, but there's no urgency to it. The thing is, like, we don't know what that situation is.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we understand the urgency to check that out. We know nothing about the lead. We are not involved in this whatsoever. That doesn't stop us from wanting the police to check it out or talking about it now because it had been put out there. Tell you what, if it was never put out there, this still would have been checked out in the spring by law enforcement. This has nothing to do with John putting this out there or not. This is not motivating police. I actually would argue that this might do the opposite of motivate police.
And I do apologize for anybody who thinks that we unnecessarily went after John about this. It's simply because there's no reason for him to put it out there. I have a problem with people who will ingratiate themselves to a family that has some mourning going on. Their daily lives are filled with this. Then say that your team, this family, and you're doing this. Like, I have a problem with that.
There are no teams and there are no sides.
Right.
And we are asked often to take sides. We're asked by John. Or we're asked by people in the community. There's Aaron's on a side. Maggie's on a side. Bill's
on
a side. Renner's on a side. John's on a side. Tell you what, there are no sides. The only side that matters is finding an answer to what happened to Maura Murray. And if anyone wants to join that side, we're here. Email us at missingmauramurray@gmail.com. One other thing from Katie here from this email. She forwards some screenshots. Someone in the Facebook group asked, why did Maggie say John isn't a private investigator? She said that because
John is not a private investigator.
He is not currently a licensed private investigator. He was a licensed private investigator at one point, just like he was
A Littleton police officer.
At one point.
On some level.
Yeah, and he's not anymore. So that is why she said that. That, again, is an accurate statement by Maggie. Here's a good one from Ryan. Just finished this week's episode. Love the fact you're doing a 5K, which, correct him, I don't think it's exactly a 5K, but the sentiment's the same. I'd love to start donating something for the silent auction, socks, ticks, or something like that. My law firm has Pat's tickets, but we're not allowed to donate them to charity without the permission of the Crafts. I can ask, though. That would be cool.
Let's get the Crafts on board.
Yeah. I'd also love to help in any way feasible with the charity, getting race sponsors and the like. I already participate in a couple. My buddy Mark, him and his wife first told him about Maura Murray, and were students when it happened at UMass. And, oh, he is the midday host on the Sports Hub, and
Mark
he can
Bertrand.
Help. That's amazing. And Ryan helps Mark with his annual fundraiser for his 501c3 that he helped him set up. And he can likely reach out to him and see if there are some people who could throw some cash away for this. He also has contacts at UMass. He used to be the president of the Alumni Association at the law school. And he's headed up to Amherst in 2 weeks for a retirement party for someone he worked with. I'm sure they'd love to hear you guys are trying to set a scholarship that could possibly use for a future UMass student. And Ryan was an avid runner until this past September when he tore his meniscus. Sorry to hear about that, Ryan.
Ouch.
They said no more running for him after surgery, but I'd kind of be a complete idiot and run this 5K in May if possible. My wife would love that stupid idea, I'm sure.
Well, tell your wife it's not a 5K. It's just going to be 1 mile, mile for Maura.
He can do it.
And you can do it.
Ryan's wife, he can do it.
Do that with one leg.
Only at the permission of your doctor. But that's a great email.
Dr. Paliri.
So thank you very much. Those are the emails that we really love getting, to be honest, and because we're trying to help. We're trying to move the ball forward, this boulder of a case forward in some way. And what really bogs us down is comments like we just read about negativity. We really want to breeze past those and get into more positive things.
One quick one here. I just want to say that people do send a lot of suggestions for the GoFundMe account, and that's awesome. And Karina said that she had a recommendation. Is there a way to pay someone to do data entry in various missing persons, police, or other beneficial databases which are backlogged? This could be an hourly project or a part-time basis. This is a really interesting idea. So if there's maybe, you know, a backlog of does, for example, Jane Does, and we needed to do some matching with DNA or dental or something, maybe that could be something that someone does on an hourly basis or, you know, a couple days a week, and we can use money from the account to do that. Let's float that idea out there, because I think that is a really unique and new use of resources.
And this one comes in from Twitter, from Rebecca LJ on Twitter. She says, I hate to be negative, but I'm really not sure why you would endorse the new podcast, Slim Turkey. I'm caught up with it and has made absolutely no sense so far. I'm quite disappointed since I love everything that you guys have done so far. Well, Rebecca, of course, you're talking about the show Slim Turkey that we played a clip from our interview with Mr. Lee Purchase in the last 10 minutes of episode 94 of this very podcast. The reason it's very simple why we played this. So we find this guy and this case to be interesting, but we also have a lot of New Hampshire listeners, and Richard Addison's killer apparently had a New Hampshire license plate. So giving the case additional publicity directly to the listeners of New Hampshire could be good for the case. Okay, Lance, so there is another clip that we want to play at the end of the episode of Julie Murray and Curtis Murray talking about their sister, Maura Murray, that was recorded last year. So we're going to play that at the end of the episode. But before we do, I just want to go over some things that we kind of noticed from Billy Jensen's old article, Lance.
Friend of the show, Billy Jensen, wrote the article in January of 2014, Will the Internet Find Missing UMass Student Maura Murray? And that's the question that he asked way back then. And we've spoken to him on occasion. He was on Crawl Space. We did the panel at CrimeCon with him. And he asked that question back in 2014, and we wanted to revisit the article because we want to actually answer some of these questions and refresh the topic a little bit, because it was a great article and he had really important questions there that should be followed up on as we do experience the developments due to the internet's sleuthing of Maura's disappearance.
Yeah, and we talked to him recently about having him back on, so that's going to be coming up soon. So it's good timing to talk about this article. I think it's relevant on the 15-year anniversary of her disappearance. So Lance, things are really a lot different now from when this article was written. And of course, this is right about the time we got involved too. But it's nice because the added publicity really answered some of these questions that were asked back then. There's some obvious stuff like the A-frame that we've gone to great lengths to get answers from. But there's also a lot of things that Billy mentions in his article that we want to talk about.
Yeah, one of the most common misconceptions is the A-frame. And with all of the people that have contacted us and donated their time and their equipment and just their manpower to go and do ground-penetrating radar and cadaver dog searches, this is all generated from the community and the discussions that happen amongst everybody who wants to solve this case, that wants to bring closure to it.
One of the things Billy talks about in this article was that a blog written by Joseph Anderson called Not Without Peril was created, and he is an attorney from Whitman, and he came across Maura's case in 2013 and started to get involved using a pseudonym, Sam Ledyard. This was when we first realized that there was this intense focus on this case and people throwing out theories and things like that. And Sam Ledger's blog and comments section really exploded.
So just know if you're listening and you contribute and you comment, you do have an impact. In 2007, according to Billy Jensen's article, pages on Facebook and MySpace, because I was around back then, were created in hopes of gathering tips, and in the Franconia City Forum, Franconia, New Hampshire, on the small town message board topics.com, more than 42,000 comments have been posted in a Maura thread in just the past 4 years. And that was in 2007 to 2011. 42,000 comments just in the small town topics board.
And here's a quote from Jeffrey Strelzin. Of course, he's a senior assistant attorney general of New Hampshire. Here from Billy's article, he says, police are, quote, aware of things that are said. But he also adds that nothing fruitful has come from do-it-yourself detectives. Has that changed, Lance, since this article has been written?
I think it's changed quite a bit.
Strelzin goes on to say, all we ask is that they do not interfere in the investigations. You would expect that. If people had information, they would contact the authorities.
Couldn't have said it better myself.
And that's a good reminder that if you do have some information, please contact the New Hampshire State Police and the New Hampshire State Police Cold Case Unit.
And we know, again, we've spoken to law enforcement, to Chuck West, and he has said that they're changing with the times. They know what's out there and they pay attention to it.
So I would say that because of the added publicity in the Oxygen show, that some of this stuff has changed. I think without citizen detecting, I don't think we'd be at the spot in the mystery that where we are right now.
We absolutely would not be. We wouldn't be doing it right now at all.
And here's a quick story that Billy goes into in his article. He says that a man named Tom Davies logged onto Anderson's site and asked what color was Mora's backpack. And black was the reply. Why do you ask? And he says, I ask because about a year after Mora disappeared, I found a black backpack in the woods behind the bathrooms at the Pemigewasset Overlook. Davies went on to say that after he found the backpack, he informed a state trooper but heard nothing since. Could the backpack still be up there? Being a father of several daughters, Davies wrote, I am haunted by Mora's disappearance. And then about a week later, a commenter named N.H. Ryder asked, was the area not far from the road? I'm going to take a look. And he wrote back later, holy crap, I almost crapped my pants. Tom is legit. I just got back from the Pemi Overlook and found the black backpack.
This is one of those stories that has been floating out there for a little while, and it causes some confusion because this was a black backpack allegedly found behind the bathrooms at the Pemigewasset Overlook. Now, there was a blue backpack that was found, correct?
I believe so. Perhaps on Greg Floyd's property or near there?
Around Hummingbird Lane.
That's right.
Okay.
Now, N.H. Ryder said that he contacted the authorities and gave them directions to find the backpack, which was around 30 miles from where Mora had last been seen. He said that he didn't have a camera to take pictures, and he said that it was frozen solid to the ground, but he went back the next day and did not find the backpack, which says that the New Hampshire State Police Cold Case Unit likely got to it before another person on the message board did.
Right. What's telling about it is Strelzin says that we are aware of the backpack.
Quote, unquote.
So, quote, yeah. Unquote, according to the article, we are aware of the backpack, so you could probably connect your dots there and say that the cold case unit did go and retrieve it.
And now Billy in this article talks about Mora's dorm room and did she leave any hint in her dorm room? And some reports claim that she packed her belongings and took art off her walls, evidence that maybe she was leaving for good. Her father says that her floors had been cleaned over Christmas break, which explains why some of the things were still in boxes. But almost everyone agrees that Mora was planning to leave campus for at least a few nights, and that's from Billy's article. So I think that's interesting because what did happen, to update that part, is that the police, the cold case unit, gave us and Maggie Freeling the photos from Mora's dorm room so we could actually see for ourselves for the very first time
what wasn't packed up.
Yeah, and what it looked like. And I think that still led to some discussion. Some people were looking deeper into those pictures. Why would she have a stereo on the shelf? This looks like a laundry bag, perhaps. So I'm not sure that it led to 100% conclusive answers, but it is at least nice to know that things are changing and heading in the direction of releasing more information.
Like the ATM still footage from her when she withdrew $280.
I would say that's one of the greatest benefits that Oxygen's show, the disappearance of Mora Murray, brought to this community, Lance, and that is those pictures of Mora Murray, those ATM still images of Mora. So here's one part, Lance, that I wanted to mention. Billy writes, the father visiting with $4,000 cash in his pocket, the crying episode, the box of wine, the map quest printout, the rag in the tailpipe. So some of those things, they have been answered at this point. We know the rag in the tailpipe. Well, we're, I would say, 99.9% sure the rag in the tailpipe was done by Mora. It just seems way too coincidental to not have been Mora Murray putting that rag there.
Yeah, I'm like 99% sure it was not somebody who wanted to do something to cause her harm.
Yeah. It was Mora putting the rag there. I think we can say that with, like we said, near certainty.
Yeah.
The $4,000 cash in Fred's pocket, we heard from Helena that there was some money still left in a bank account, and Mora could still currently access that if she wanted to by using her social security number.
Yeah, regardless of what people think about Fred going to multiple ATMs, to take out cash for a car. That's sort of like his business as far as how he buys a car, what he wants to do to put a down payment on a car. If he wants to go to multiple ATMs to do it, then so be it. That's his business.
And Billy says the crying episode. We do have some answers on that now, thanks to Oxygen's The Disappearance of Maura Murray television show, where they talked to Kathleen Murray, who was on the phone with Maura that night, and she told Maggie Freeling what made Maura so upset that night.
And we also spoke to Curtis recently on one of our episodes, and he gave us a little bit of insight, actually a lot of insight, into the relationship Kathleen had with Maura and Curtis and Julie and where that stemmed from.
Not to mention, since this article, we have spoken to Maura's supervisor, Karen Mayotte, in episode 84 of this show. We sat with her right here in the studio, and we went over this crying episode with her in great detail. So please check that out if you'd like. But essentially, these things are kind of crossed off the list of unanswerable, mysterious questions.
And when you look at all of these, like the rag in the tailpipe, Maura crying at her job when she got off the phone, and all of these questions that are brought up, all of these red herrings, if you will, I guess, if you take a step back, and we say this all the time, and you look at it at face value, these things do line up. Kathleen had a strained relationship due to circumstances that she couldn't control, and something like this phone call that happened, she doesn't really have to say much in order to put Maura over the edge and make her concerned about her sister because of that relationship that has become stressful.
And here Billy writes that Fred was even more upset with the Haverhill PD when they issued a press release 2 days after Maura's disappearance claiming that she was, quote, possibly suicidal. And I think that has sort of disappeared from common beliefs now as well, Lance, don't you?
I agree. Where that statement that the police released comes from is because Fred had said early on that she might have walked into the woods to kill herself, more or less. That statement that Fred said sort of has to be taken with a giant grain of salt, because this is the few days right after his daughter is missing, and he just probably didn't know what to say. So I could totally relate to him being upset that they would put out a press release about that specifically.
Totally.
And it's unfortunate that we look back on it so many years later and say, well, you know, at least the public doesn't think that now. I mean, I just wish that would have been the case back then.
Yeah, and Oxygen's The Disappearance of Maura Murray's show really talked about the searches done in the immediate area after Maura's disappearance. And it really doesn't seem likely that she is in the immediate area. I know, the grounds, the woods cannot be beaten enough in search for Maura, but based on the conversation with Todd Bogardis from Fish and Game, they did a great search.
Maura being one of only two that Mr. Bogardis was not able to locate in the White Mountain region.
Don't you think that if Maura told Fred before she went missing that she was suicidal or depressed or was thinking about hurting herself, that would be out by now?
Absolutely. And if not Fred, maybe Julie, maybe Curtis, maybe Bill, maybe Kate Markopoulos, anybody else, that she might have had specific thoughts of hurting herself. And we've never heard that from anybody, that it was even a possibility. We've heard the exact opposite.
Yeah, it was only made in this press release and by Fred pretty much immediately when he heard about it. And then he took that back, basically, admitted he misspoke.
Also, when you look at the things that she had prepared in her car and the things that she had bought on the way up, do not suggest that someone's going up there to kill themselves.
And the last one I wanted to talk about here, Lance, is this John Healy paragraph, of course, the John Healy of the New Hampshire League of Investigators. And it says here in Billy's article that Fred initially worked closely with Healy and his group. In 2005, though, when Fred sued the state police in an attempt to make public all of the reports pertaining to the investigation, Healy and his volunteers publicly disagreed with Fred's effort. And then that is when conflicts arose with Fred and the New Hampshire League of Investigators, and they kind of stopped working together at that point. Healy is quoted as saying, "He shut the door on me and the whole group of volunteers ever since." And he goes on to say, "We're doing this for their whole family," end quote.
It's a really unfortunate situation where you have a group of investigators who are doing this on their own time and their own dollar for the most part, and out of the goodness of their heart. And I'm not saying that John Healy is disingenuous when he says we're doing this for their whole family, but I think that line, And again, I'm not saying that this is a case with Healy, but I think that line is a little too commonly used and a little too easy when you're not able to say yourself that you are obsessed with this case and solving it is not for the family, it's for you. And we're guilty of that on some level as well.
Definitely.
We would want this case to be solved. We would want to be a part of that and say, yeah, we helped solve this case. And it's a pride thing. Maybe at the time, Healy is legitimately and genuinely doing it for the family. I believe that there's a part of him that is. But I also believe that there are people who use that line in a disingenuous way because they want that fulfillment themselves.
Well, really why I wanted to bring it up is because Healy had the opportunity to work with Oxygen's The Disappearance of Maura Murray TV show. And the point of this segment of this episode is how things have changed. And unfortunately, his decision to work with people and publicize the work that he did, maybe get a sprinkle little information from their investigation that was almost 15 years ago now out there into the public. Maybe you need to change your way of thinking a little bit because it seems like the public perception of information flow, police officers working with podcasters, working with media, as evidenced by the Attorney General's Office of New Hampshire working with Oxygen's The Disappearance of Maura Murray, there's no reason to hold all that information back at this point.
Really, let yourself be used as a tool for the people who can actually create some sort of difference here. Healy and his group, they are able to go out there and gather information just like you and I are able to sit here and talk and talk and talk and just make sure that people don't ever forget about this. But we get information and we distribute it right back to law enforcement when we can. Like anytime we get that, we try to do the right thing with it and we don't put it out there to the public in such a way where we're trying to show how much work we're doing like as a boots on the ground type effort. So I think at some point you almost have to swallow your pride and say, I am not in this alone. I am more of a tool for law enforcement.
Yeah, and other investigators like us, Lance, they have gotten information. They have decided whether to put it out there or not. James Renner, a notable example. Erin Deborah Larkin, another example. John Smith, another one. Here's a good example of what Erin dug up. She got Faith Westman and Butch Atwood's 911 calls and put them out there. That is not a mystery anymore.
Right, and that's good.
Excellent.
Yes, that's excellent. There's nothing in those documents that's suspicious. There's nothing that would indicate that somebody did anything, caused Maura any harm. It's just it's a simple breakdown, essentially, of a time frame and who did what when.
Okay, and here is a clip from last year's vigil with Curtis Murray, Julie Murray, Art Roderick, and Maggie Freeling, and us, Lance. Thank you very much for listening. We hope you enjoy it.
Did she climb all 48 of the 4,000 footers? She was well on her way. My dad did.
Yeah.
And we were actually talking about that today.
Wow.
Mara did many of them with him. I did some before I went to West Point. But no, she didn't get all of them. But she would have.
Yeah, 100%.
Mm-hmm. Did she have a favorite hobby outside of running? Any sport?
Yeah. Or making salads.
Making salads.
I've heard huge things about her liking to eat big salads.
Huge salads. Yeah. That was probably a big hobby for her because it'd be a production. That was another thing.
Like she would like mix up the different kinds of vegetables.
Yeah, or, like, it was just it would be a bowl like this and everyone had to try it because it was like a big cheese and apples and all sorts of stuff. She used to make those all the time.
Yeah. Oh, Laura Wright. We went to school with Laura. Hey, Laura. She said the Hanson turkey trot, Julia Maura always won. Oh, Maura always won.
By good margin, too. I remember being in the crowd and watching. It's like, where is everybody else?
What was Mara's favorite thing she owned?
Throughout the course, I think it might have been her Cutlass. Do you remember when she got her Cutlass or car? Mm-mm. Yeah, she had like a horrible tan Cutlass Supreme, and that was like her pride and joy. That car, it was horrible. It belched smoke. I took many a ride in it. That was like her crown jewel as long as she had it.
Wow.
Yeah, her first car.
That was her first car.
That was her first car. Yeah. It was a horror show, but she loved that thing.
From Casey, what would have made Maura a great nurse?
Probably her compassion.
Definitely her compassion.
Just a really, really compassionate person. She would have excelled at it like everything else. Yeah, she would have definitely knocked that out of the park. She would have been an unbelievable nurse.
Favorite class in high school?
Chemistry.
Really?
Oh, wow.
Well, as evidenced by her Christmas retreat table. For fun. Who does that?
Yeah, she was brilliant at math. Loved chemistry.
Yeah.
What is the goofiest thing you remember Maura doing?
Oh, God.
Just doing, pranks on probably you.
Yeah.
Pranking Curtis or making him eat something or, like...
Oh, my God.
Just pranking Curtis, trying to make you laugh.
Yeah. She was just a total goofball in most ways. Yeah, always trying to make us laugh.
Was there anywhere she always wanted to travel to?
She was going to come to Myrtle Beach in March. This is interesting. Her and one of her friends at UMass were coming to visit me. I was at Fort Bragg. And we had a phone conversation maybe 2 weeks before she went missing about her planning spring break with me. So she was going to come to Fort Bragg, and then we were all going to drive down to Myrtle Beach together. So I don't know if that would have been her favorite, but that was something that she was planning to do.
But it was also it just wasn't a phone call. It was IMing back and forth.
Absolutely,
about getting
ready for
the trip, and I'm looking forward to this.
Right. Yeah. And that's why when people say, oh, she was disappearing, well, not really, because she was also planning a spring break trip with me.
Right.
Who, if you're going to disappear, you don't plan spring break.
Right.
Was Maura a morning person or a night owl?
Night owl.
Night owl, big time. Mm-hmm.
She seems to be a ball of energy.
Yes.
Yeah, big time. But waking her up could be tough. Or dangerous.
She did like Dane Cook. I think she went to see Dane Cook with her Hanson friends.
Oh, yeah, that's so. Scott just mentioned the story that Liz told. She was just like an adventurer, and one day she just like hopped the train to go to Boston and adventure on her own. She was just a free spirit.
Yeah.
Yep.
Her friends Liz and Kate told me that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she definitely loved going to the city, that's for sure.
Yeah. Right, because to get from you guys to Boston is pretty quick.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not bad.
Did you guys visit North Conway yearly? Yes, every summer. At least 2 weeks. It would be the big event of the year, especially middle school, high school. And we would spend 1 week camping at Jigga Johnson Campground. And the second week, my dad would rent a cottage.
In Edelweiss Village.
In Edelweiss, yep.
Yep.
And we would do canoeing and hiking and anything outdoorsy.
Here's Kathleen agreeing. Yeah, night owl. Perfect. I shared a room with her.
Was she goofy or serious? She was goofy,
big time.
But she was also serious about school and her work too, though, right?
Right, yeah. And I always was jealous of that part because it came to her so easy.
Yeah, it was natural.
I would have to study for hours and hours and hours, and she'd just get it and take the test and ace it. Get recruiting letters to Harvard and things like that.
Right. Yeah. Your dad was telling me the list of schools she was recruited to. Mm-hmm. Harvard, yeah. Yale was one of them too, right?
Yeah, she had her pick.
Yep.
Yeah, she could have gone anywhere.
Did we play video games?
Oh, yeah.
So, my mom was obsessed with Metroid. Do you guys remember that old video game?
Yeah, and Zelda.
Zelda.
Atari.
Atari or
Nintendo, maybe.
And, the regular Nintendo.
Okay.
Yeah,
the Mario, Super Mario Brothers.
Mm, yeah.
But for some reason, my mom would play it, and Mara would like try to snatch the controller away from my mom and tell it short.
Mom, you're terrible.
Yeah.
Yep.
So we played a little bit, but we weren't inside kids at all.
Right.
Yeah.
I like that it was that she couldn't watch your mom not do as well as she could do.
Yeah, she had to like
take the remote. Yeah. I love that.
Defuse the situation before it got worse.
I used to take that role sometimes too.
Yeah. What was her favorite board game?
Okay, we would play Monopoly for hours.
Yeah, Monopoly was it.
Yep.
100%.
100%. For hours. Like, we would play games that would continue on to the next day.
Yeah.
Like, we'd take, like, a military pause or whatever it's called. And hope that no one would steal the money or, like, do a swap for the properties and pick it up the next day.
Scott says he knows she was competitive and he's coached for years and he was always curious how Maura would have dealt with losing.
She was gracious.
Yeah.
Was there ever a time you can remember her losing?
There's a time where I remember she let me win.
She let you win?
Yeah.
How do you know?
Oh, because it was my senior year in cross country and I had an undefeated season. And it was the last meet of the regular season before you went into states and all that kind of stuff. And we were running together and I was pushing my hardest and she was right beside me and she totally could have beat me and she just let me beat her by one step. It was the same time, but she wanted me to have that undefeated season. Again, goes to show, like, what kind of person does that? That was pretty awesome.
That's how she was.
Yeah.
Did you talk about that afterwards or it was just kind of known that...
It was something we didn't need to talk about. Yeah. I don't know how my dad dealt with us.
I saw it because you guys used to take me when you were training. Like if you were babysitting,
Oh, we were fierce in training, but when it came down to the race, for some reason, it was different. We just wanted each other to do well.
There was Kathleen had a comment up there about...
Dad would take the controls away when we were misbehaving, but we would find them anyway. Yeah. I was talking about the video game
controls.
What was her first job?
Was it Heidi's Hollow?
Did she work there?
Did she pick raspberries there?
I don't know.
That's where I met Liz and Katie.
Oh, that was our spot.
Right,
because
that was the spot.
Yeah.
I know about Heidi's Hollow.
I don't remember if she worked there, but
We should not mention Heidi's Hollow. So Heidi's Hollow, for those that don't know, is a local ice cream shop in Hanson, and it is amazing. It's still there.
Good ice cream.
Yeah, very good ice cream. And we would go there any chance we could get.
Yep.
It's a very funky. I don't know if it was like that back then, but there's like weird stuff all over the walls.
Yeah.
Okay.
They have a barn full of like old antiques and stuff. Yeah. Yeah, you guys taught me also. It's a lesson there. Because when I was a kid, I was really shy. And I'd go up to order ice cream at the counter. And they would both yell at me because I was so quiet that the girls behind the counter couldn't hear me. So you always tell me, speak up, Curtis. Look people in the eyes. Speak up.
Drill instructor.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Good lessons. Good lessons they took.
Someone said Peaceful Meadows. That's another ice cream place local on the South Shore. We definitely spent a lot of time there as well.
Rachel says she wants to let you know that because of this, she's going to call her sister tonight. She says sisters have very powerful bonds, and her thoughts are with you guys tonight.
Oh, thanks. Thank you. I love Fred's accent.
What, he has an accent?
No. Definitely original.
I guess you'd call that a South Shore accent. Is that a South Shore
accent?
Yes.
Definitely. Yes.
Mar had the accent too.
She had a lot of that.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I used to. I lost it a little bit. Oh, this is a kind of cute picture. This was in our local paper. And it's Mara with a Harvard shirt on. She looks, I don't know, maybe 8. And my dad and then me, we were doing some kind of training, and the local paper stopped and asked my dad a question, and he gave some long, drawn-out answer of some sort. But it's a cute picture. I love this picture.
All right, and then I have this one of Mara and my mother. My mother was huge into gardening, so they did that together all the time.
Oh, that's adorable.
Yeah, the front yard was always immaculate.
And Mara was into that, too?
Yeah.
When was that?
That'd have to be... Well, she was in high school anyways.
Can I just say something from my law enforcement perspective way down here at the end? I have never been through anything like this. This is the first time I think I've actually come close to a family that's had this type of incident in their lives. And this blows me away. I mean, I haven't been able to say much, but you try to remove yourself from this stuff so you can take, you know, the 35,000 foot level look at all the stuff that's gone on in this particular case. I'm with you, you know, from the very beginning that this is a solvable case. I think the New Hampshire State Police believe this is a solvable case. But when you sit here and you listen to the stories and you look at the photographs and you see the stuff that the stories you guys are telling, it's just heart-wrenching. And thanks for having me here. Law enforcement usually doesn't get an opportunity to do this.
Well, like I said at the beginning, we can't thank you enough, you and Maggie both, and everything you've done. We wouldn't have this right here if it weren't for you guys and the Texas crew, so thank you.
Karen asks,
yeah, good question.
Did she smile all the time or just for photos?
All the time.
Constantly. And that smile could brighten up a room just like that.